Mankind has never found peace in a scrap of paper. However solemnly signed and ceremonially promulgated, no peace treaty has ever truly ended conflicts between nations. Treaties are made to be broken, and as soon as one power or another sees an advantage, or as soon as another government seizes power in one of these nations and renounces the treaty, it is as if it has never been. The Treaty of Versailles, which ended the first global war, gave Europe enough peace in order to grow another generation of cannon fodder. The Middle East will not find peace in a scrap of paper unless we recognize that the tensions between nations are ongoing, unless we recognize that when the political tensions between nations are aggravated by passion, by deliberately flamed hate, unless we recognize that what is being sought in the Middle East is an accommodation, a modus vivendi, some arrangements which will keep the big guns from shooting and the fast planes from flying, unless we keep our feet on the ground and do not ask for too much, unless we recognize that what we are talking about is some temporary arrangement which will buy time, save lives, there is no hope for any kind of serious confrontation of the issues. Because if anyone is under the illusion that a peace settlement will stabilize the area, will bring around some kind of permanent solution to the problems between Israel and the Arab states and within the Arab states themselves, he is buying disappointment. He is asking to be disillusioned. One can almost write, even now, the scenario of the events after a peace settlement. Let's assume what is not even problematic, but let's assume what will probably not be, but is the best that could be, that the Arab states will accept some accommodation of boundaries with Israel, that they will agree to open the Straits of Tehran and the Suez Canal to all flag traffic, that there will be arrangement for the sacred places of Jerusalem, that there will be some provision for the treatment of all the displaced persons of the Middle East, both Arab and Jew. Let's assume that all of the seemingly outstanding issues are adjusted, that the paragraphs are carefully written. And furthermore, let's assume that a big four peacekeeping task force is sent to the area, its companies to be astride both sides of these borders to keep the peace. What then? How long would it be before one of the revolutionary cells of guerrillas in Iraq or in Jordan begins to agitate against this treaty of infamy? How long would it be before some of the political opponents of Mr. Sadat, or whoever was the Egyptian president who signed these protocols, how long would it be before this opponent or that opponent emerged as the demagogue at the head of a Hitlerian kind of operation, where this is exactly what Hitler did with the Treaty of Versailles, denouncing this treaty, saying we must drive all the aliens, all of the foreigners from Dar al-Islam, from Islam's land, from the Arab world. You were sold out. You were abandoned. Come back to your principles. I will lead you on the Holy Crusade. How long would it be before guerrilla bands begin to sift into Israel to plant the bombs? Or some kind of terrorist activity would shoot up a cargo ship bound for Israel in the Suez Canal? And what if Israel tried to retaliate? how many of the peacekeeping companies of Russians and French and English would be sieves through which the terrorists could pass going westward, but through which the Israeli army could not pass going eastward. This has happened before. It happened with the United Nations peacekeeping forces in the early 60s. How long would it be before tensions build up and finally the demagogue now astride in Egypt or in the throne in Jordan, before he suddenly and peremptorily demands of the Russians and of the French, who are the allies of the Arab world, that they pull out from the peacekeeping force? They're no longer wanted. Thank you for your guns, thank you for your planes, thank you for your missiles, but no thank you for the cordon sanitaire, the barrier which we've erected between us and the final attack. Mr. Sadat, the new president of Egypt since the death of Gamal Abdel Nasser, has proven to be a remarkably loquacious fellow. He has in the last months traveled the length and breadth of his land, encouraging the people who come throng out in the public squares of Damietta and Alexandria and Cairo. We will win the war. No part of Arab territory will remain under foreign domination. We must be prepared to take the kinds of aggressive actions which will ensure us our rights. And to give visible content to his oratory, he has now brought into being a national militia. All civilian men in Egypt up to the age of 35 who are not in the army have been given arms. And they have told they will be led forward, but they must be prepared in the meantime for some kind of Israeli attack. It's only a matter of time till we launch out to take back that which is legitimately ours. And when he was interviewed by James Reston of the New York Times, he said very simply, never, never, never will I negotiate with the Israeli. Now in the West, the thought has developed, the assumption has developed in recent years that the Arabs never mean what they say. That they are children of bombast, that they love oratory, that they talk to hear themselves talk, that you must not listen to what they say because it's really not meant. They talk in a kind of symbolic, hyperbolic language. Leave it at that. Well, let's leave it at that. Let's accept that Mr. Sadat does not mean what he has said, that he will never, never, never seriously negotiate with the Israelis. Why then these speeches? Obviously, he needs, at the very least, to identify himself with the basic passion of his people. The flames of hate, the flames of revenge, the flames of vengeance, which have burned so brightly, which have been kept burning so brightly by Arab propaganda for these last 25 years. He obviously doesn't want anyone coming behind him doing that which Southern politicians in the United States 10, 20 years ago most feared. When they ran for office, the thing they feared most was that some other politician would come along and say worse things about the Negroes than they were prepared to say. Now, why does a Sadat have to engage in this kind of vulgarity, this kind of deliberate inflammation of passion? Obviously, because the passions are real. Obviously, because they are there, because they have been cultivated. Can they be done away with overnight? Will they not be there if a scrap of paper is signed? Have not these people, many of them semi-literate, most of them poor, been encouraged to believe that this is a jihad, a holy war, a holy crusade? What would happen to the man who signs the paper? How long would it be before prophet of vengeance, a demagogue arises and elbows him out of power and takes over the nation and burns the scrap of paper. If anyone wants to understand why Israel is so careful of its security arrangements, is so determined that whatever happens in these negotiations, nothing will happen which will undermined her viability. Let him understand the nature of political life in the Middle East. The idealists of the world are bedazzled by peace. Everyone wants peace. Everyone wears peace jewelry. Peace has become a marketable commodity. Everybody wants peace. But sometimes the desperate urge for peace is the best way to bring about a second round or a third or a fourth, a new war. And if by peace we mean simply that peace which is imposed upon the smallest of the parties involved, Israel, a peace which cuts into her ability to survive, which removes, let's say, the buffer of land which she now has between her enemies and her economic heart, her cities, if we take from Israel, but do not give Israel hard, valid, reasonable, realistic assurances in return, all that we have done is to increase the tensions in the area, increase Israel's need to attack quickly if she is threatened, increase the Arab world's appetite to gulp more than she has yet digested. The problem is this. The idealists, the peaceniks of our world, think that the issue in the Middle East is simply to return the situation to the status quo ante, to what existed before May, June of 1967. Talk to the average well-intentioned but only semi-aware individual about the Middle East, and they say, yes, the issue is for Israel to withdraw to the 1967 borders. The issue is to assure Israel a freedom of passage through the major waterways of the area. The issue is to guarantee some kind of international control over the shrines in Jerusalem. The issue is to begin a solution to the rehabilitation of the problem of those who have been displaced, both Arab and Jew, in the Middle East in the last 20 or 25 years, so-called refugee problem. And that's the issue. But that's not the issue. And no Arab leader in the last 25 years has ever said that it is the issue. In the Arab mind, the issue is the existence of the State of Israel. And behind the question of rollback to 67, behind that issue which occupies so much of the space which fills our newspapers, beyond that issue, there are a number of others, cards that they're ready to play. One of the things which we must assure ourselves of is this, that there have been no signals from the Arab world that there is a point at which she will say, this is what is acceptable to us. Once we have gotten this far, we make no more demands upon Israel. Rather, what you have is this. Yes, let's achieve a withdrawal, a roll back. Israel has everything to lose, we have everything to gain. We will be able to cross the Suez Canal without the expense and manpower of a cross-canal amphibious operation. We'll be able to gain back the mineral and oil resources of the Sinai. We'll be able to move our troops up to within minutes of the major cities of Israel, and now that we have the very sophisticated Luna ground-to-ground missile which the Russians have given us, the most devastating weapon of war yet introduced in the Middle East, we'll be able to cover Israel from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Jerusalem with the rain of our cannon. But what else? What happens if Israel rolls back? What's the next item on the agenda of demands? Well, it's the item of the borders of 1948. The Arabs have never accepted the legitimacy of the borders of the 1950s and the 1960s. They are ceasefire borders. brought about, of course, because the Arab states in 1947 would not accept the UN partition decision and attacked the Yishuv and were determined to drive the Yishuv into the sea. And when the Israelis fought back, the borders which were there as of June or July of 1948 became the semi-permanent borders of the area. But the partition borders, the borders described at the United Nations at Lake Success in 1947, are narrower than those which Israel has enjoyed these last 20 years. So there is always the legalistic claim, we want Israel to pull back to the borders of 1948. And if that were achieved, what's the next item on this agenda? The internationalization of Jerusalem. In the partition decision, the United Nations voted to internationalize Jerusalem. But when the Arab Legion, the Jordanian Legion, marched across the Jordan and gobbled up the West Bank, which was intended to be originally an Arab state, an independent Arab state, and marched into Jerusalem, seeking to capture Jerusalem for itself, the Jewish citizens of Jerusalem appealed to the United Nations for troops for their defense. You have demanded this city as your city, now defended. No troops were sent. The Israelis had to defend themselves. The divided city came into being. But the issue, the legalistic issue, remains active on the Arab agenda. The borders of 1948, the issue of the internationalization of Jerusalem, the destruction of Israel's very capital. And beyond that, there is the issue of the rehabilitation and the return of the Arab refugees. 1,200,000 or the original 600,000, that is arguable. What is demanded is that these people be returned to the land, to the homes from which they fled at the provocation of their own leaders 23 years ago. Rehabilitation, we do not accept. Restitution for the lands of the almost 2 million Jews who have been dispossessed from the Arab world in the intervening years, this is not an issue. What is at issue is simply the absolute right of these people to return, presumably the absolute right to return to their national home. The results, in terms of Israeli security, in terms of the disruption of the economy, that's of no concern to us. This is an absolute right. And beyond the issue of the 1948 boundaries and beyond the issue of the internationalization of Jerusalem and beyond the refugee issue, there is the issue of what is now being called the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination. A new entity has come into being through Arab propaganda called the Palestinian people. Lo haya v'lo nivra. It never existed before in history. Most of the Arabs who were in Palestine in the 1940s came into Palestine in the 1920s and 1930s from Iraq and from Syria because the Jews had brought prosperity to the land and they were drawn there as magnets. There was work there. But now there is something called the Palestinian people, and they presumably have inalienable rights. Now, the Arabs are not talking simply about an independent Arab state on the West Bank. That's already assumed. They're talking about the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people to determine what's right for the state of Israel. First, their return, and they talk in grand terms of a binational state, of an open society, of Israeli nationalism. But once they have returned, they speak also, interestingly, of the forced exit of all the Jews who have come illegally into Israel, that is all the European Jews who are now in Israel. Yes, we will accept the Oriental Jews who have lived in this land for 1,000 years, 150,000, but all the rest must go. About 10 years ago, Mr. Nasser finally learned that the bombast, the oratory to which he was accustomed, did not set well with the West. Remember how he used to speak of coming into Tel Aviv not on a red carpet, but in a carpet of blood? And how he would drive the Israelis into the sea? Well, that oratory was counterproductive, was put aside. Now he began to speak in terms which he thought would be attractive to the West, to the idealists in the West. He talked of the rights of the Palestinian people, never of the rights of the Jews of Egypt to survive in security in Egypt, but the rights of something called the Palestinian people, inalienable rights in Palestine. He talked of never compromising these rights, of the necessity of all states to be free and to be open and to be democratic. Suddenly it appeared as if Israel was a closed, tyrannical, chauvinist society. There are 14 Arab states. There are 14 million square miles of Arab land. 25 years ago, there were some 3 million Jews in Dar Islam, in the Arab world. Today there are less than 100,000. Where have all the Jews gone? Why have they gone, almost everyone? They have all gone because of chauvinism, because of exclusivism, because of racism. Their lands, their rights have been expropriated. Many of these people have lived in these lands far longer than the Arabs. The Jews of Iran, the Jews of Iraq, the Jews of Lebanon, the Jews of Egypt have been in those countries for 1,000 years and more, 2,000 years and more. The question in the Middle East is whether the Arab world is prepared to put aside this whole unstated agenda of demands. If, in fact, Mr. Sadat and Hussein are willing to negotiate on the basis of the issues raised by 1967, the issues raised by the United Nations resolution of November of 67, that is, withdrawal, the defensible borders, free passage through the Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba, some final resolution of the problem of the displaced, of the refugee, some assurance about the internationalization of the religious shrines of Jerusalem. If this is the agenda, and the whole agenda, then obviously there can be serious and meaningful talk, and serious and meaningful compromise. But if, as many suspect, what we're dealing here is with part of a political tactic, not with a final system of negotiations, then I'm afraid that the world is in for a disappointment. Because I am convinced that if I, reading our papers, can analyze the hopes and the desires and the ploys of the Arab world, the Israeli Foreign Office analyzed these long, long ago. What is at issue? An issue is, as the Israelis have suggested from the very beginning, is the integrity and the survival of the state of Israel. That's non-negotiable for the Israeli. But it is obviously something which is desired by the Arab world. I think it's important for us, because we tend to read these stories as they appear day by day in the paper, to review, to refresh ourselves as to how these negotiations came about. Perhaps we can see all this more clearly. There was the war in 1967. And after the 1967 war was over, the United Nations came into meeting, the Security Council, and passed in November of that year a resolution, which, as I've said, stated the basic issues which had to be negotiated between the parties. Mr. Gunnar Jahring was appointed as the representative of the United Nations to be the intermediary, to promote the resolution of November of 1967. And if you recall the papers of those days, you read how Jahring seemed to be permanently shuttling between Cairo and Amman and Jerusalem and New York, moving here and there. The Israelis were eager for some kind of final solution, some peace. They talked of meeting face to face with the leaders of all the nations. The Arabs were always eager to keep these negotiations at the lowest common denominator, not in the Middle East, but far from the Middle East, at New York. not with the leaders of the state or even the foreign ministers of the state, but with the representatives, ambassadorial representatives at the United Nations. And they insisted from the very beginning that the issue was not to a package deal in which all of the items would be brought together for some kind of final resolution, but that it had to be first the automatic withdrawal of Israel from all the Arab territories, the territories that were occupied in 67, and then perhaps the rest could be laid on the table and discussed. I check myself, not laid on the table, discussed informally with the Arab ambassador to the United Nations speaking in this direction, Mr. Yaring, who then circles around and who speaks in this direction to the Israeli. We are not to admit that Israel exists. Mr. Yaring was unsuccessful in bringing about the simplest of negotiations, of getting an agenda to begin with. And during those months, Russia was, as you recall, busily rebuilding the destroyed arsenal of the Egyptians. Russia began to send in her pilots, her missile experts into Egypt. And finally, in August of 1968, Mr. Nasser announced as the basic policy of the Arab world, a position which no one has yet canceled, I quote it to you, the following principles of Egyptian policy are immutable. 1, no negotiation with Israel. 2, no peace with Israel. 3, no recognition of Israel. 4, no transactions will be made at the expense of Palestinian territories or the Palestinian people. And with that great declaration, he unleashed what was to be a war of attrition. The cannon began to bombard the east side of the Suez. His planes began to foray deep into Sinai. His guerrillas began to take the little rubber barges during the night to come across and to plant explosives. The terrorists were unleashed. And Israel's response was swift, and it was sudden, and it was devastating. The Israeli Air Force was let loose, and the Israeli Air Force gained control of the skies and was able to carry out raids deep within Egyptian territory. The Egyptians and the Russians were shocked at the success of the Israeli counterattack. And they began to move in greater and greater supplies, and the Russians began to take over the actual fighting of the war, not only manning the missile sites, but actually their pilots scrambling into planes and flying missions. Finally, in January of this year, by the way, Mr. Sadat, in one of his more loquacious moves, admitted that at one point, in one day in January of last year, 6 of the Russians were killed by Israelis in one particular attack. But they were not able to regain mastery of the sky. The war was escalating. There was obvious danger. The Israelis were on the ascendant. And the United States was obviously eager for a lowering of the decibel destruction, for some kind of arrangement. And Mr. Rogers and Mr. Sisko, with great elan, you recall in August of this year, arranged a standstill ceasefire. Israel was the only one who had anything to lose by this ceasefire, because she could lose the control of the skies, which she had won with her lives. But she was willing to test what Mr. Rogers said was a new mood among the Egyptians and among the Russians. The guns fell silent, and the typical Arab response to negotiations began to unfold. Standstill ceasefire took place at midnight at 12:01. The more sophisticated SAM-3 missiles began to move forward closer and closer to the canal. Proved in the event that the United States had never even arranged for careful surveillance of this canal area for the standstill, the freeze. In any case, the ceasefire was in effect, and in effect also was the Russian-Egyptian ploy of creating a dense missile screen all the way up to the Suez Canal. The 6 months of the accepted ceasefire gave to the Egyptians 3 things. The first, it regained for them control of the skies over Egypt. Secondly, because of the range of the SAM-3 missiles, it gained for them some control of the sky over the Israeli line, the Barlev line on the other side of the Suez. And third, it gave to some 8,000 Russian technicians and soldiers who are now in Egypt, amphibious experts, a chance to train three Egyptian divisions in amphibious attack procedures. The months passed. The world had a breathing spell. Mr. Yarings was supposed to have gone into his work again in August, but of course, because of the contumacious, contemptible way in which the Arabs had flaunted the purpose of the ceasefire, the Israelis never allowed the negotiations to proceed. As the negotiations were for 6 months, they were to end on the 5th of February. As January began to pass, America began to become more and more concerned again about a new fighting in the Middle East. Our concerns are many, primarily due to the fact that it is Russia who is on the front line. We have a large, great power east-west confrontation. We were eager to find peace, as we were always, I suppose, eager to find peace. We began to look for ways in which to bring the Yarring mission into focus again, to begin negotiations again. And there were no signals by the Egyptians or by the Jordanians that they were willing to negotiate seriously. But there were some signals that they were not prepared necessarily to begin fighting again on the 5th of February. And by hard talk, the United States giving certain assurances to the Egyptians, primarily that some boundary divisions described by Mr. Rogers in October of 1968, which return Israel almost exactly to the boundaries of 67, would be those which would be acceptable to the United States. And now we discover also that the United States would reconvene the Big Four power talks. She was able to encourage Egypt to undergo one 30-day extension to this ceasefire. Israel was being pushed, if you will, towards re-entering the Yarring talks for many reasons. As Mrs. Meir said, we want peace. There were also reasons to believe that there might be a new mood on the other side. Hussein had faced civil war in the fall and had come out victorious. The degree of the defeat of the Arab guerrillas is only now becoming apparent. We remember last spring the great romantic buildup of this unstoppable force of freedom-fighting guerrillas who were the wave of the future in the Middle East, or so our American press told us. Well, these freedom-fighting guerrillas proved not even equal to Hussein's army. They were very badly mauled. Perhaps Hussein would be in a different mood. Nasser had died. Sadat would come into power. Perhaps he, too, might be willing to be more accommodating. He might not have the megalomania that Nasser had. And then, obviously, the desire of the United States for peace had to be taken into consideration by the Israeli government. General Dayan said, there are times when we must swim in cold water. So knowing all of the risks and all of the dangers, and the issues are far more complex than even we understand, the Israelis agreed to the resumption of Mr. Yarring's mission, and they summoned him to Jerusalem. And the world thought that they were summoning him to Jerusalem for some kind of procedural wrangle. But instead, they presented to him then on the 17th of January a list of 14 points which they felt are the basis for any meaningful solution to the problems of the Middle East. Let me read them to you. One. The declared and explicit decision to regard the conflict as finally terminated. Two, respect and acknowledgement by the parties in explicit terms of each other's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence. Three, establishment of secure, recognized, and agreed boundaries. Four, other additional arrangements for ensuring security. Five, withdrawal of military forces from territories lying beyond positions agreed in the peace treaty. Six, termination of all states of war and acts of hostility or belligerency. 7, the responsibility for ensuring that no warlike act or violence by any organization, group, or individual originates from or is committed in its territories against the population, citizens, or property of the other party. 8, termination of all discriminations or interferences, economic warfare, and all its manifestations, including boycott. This obligation is not dependent on anything except the conclusion of the state of war. 9, provisions laying down the obligations accepted by the parties toward the settlement of the refugee problem, after which neither party shall be under claims from the other inconsistent with its sovereignty. 10, arrangements concerning places of religious and historic significance. 11, arrangement for free port and transit facilities. 12, non-participation in hostile alliances and the prohibition of stationing of troops of other parties which maintain a state of belligerency against the other. 13, non-interference in domestic affairs and non-interference in the normal foreign relations of the other party. And 14, peace must be expressed in a binding treaty in accordance with normal law and precedent. All the issues were laid on the table. There was nothing that Israel was not prepared to discuss or to negotiate. And the Egyptian response was first to be stunned, I think, by the willingness of the Israelis to raise all these issues as issues of substance, to move immediately beyond procedure. And then their offer was the magnanimous offer of allowing the Israelis to withdraw some miles beyond the Suez Canal so the Suez Canal could be opened. Now, what would that do? It would ensure that the Egyptians could have troops on the east bank of the canal without the expense of a cross-canal attack. It would shore up the Egyptian economy by hundreds of millions of dollars a year from the canal transportation. What would it do for Israel? Not a thing, obvious. Now that's negotiation, United Arab Republic style. We have yet to make, to understand, to have any signal from either the Soviet or the United Arab Republic that they are willing to engage in serious negotiation. The Israeli cartoonist, Dosh, had a brilliant little cartoon the other day where you saw a swimming pool and the diving board, and there was a little Israeli on the diving board crouched over. There was Dayan's line, you know, sometimes you have to swim in cold water, and he was saying to himself, but what if there's no water in there? There may not be. And the Israelis are going into this round of negotiations rather cynically, realistically, cold-eyed. But nonetheless, you must risk for peace, and they're prepared to make certain risks for it. Now, I think during these next months, the challenge will be whether or not those in the West who've always sympathized with Israel as a democracy, have understood her basic love of peace, whether they're willing to understand the large complexity of issues involved, or whether they are so bemused by peace, the word rather than the substance, the hope rather than the reality. They lean heavily on Israel to try and force her to break, to give up her few bargaining ploys without anything of substance in return. It's going to be a long period. It's going to be a frustrating period. In many ways, it's going to be a bitter period, because Israel will seem to be standing adamant, as if she's unwilling to bend. Well, she has bent and she has bent again. She bent in August of this year. The Egyptians gave up nothing. She gave up an advantage. She bent in January of this year. She wanted face-to-face negotiations at the highest possible level, serious talk. The Egyptians wanted this masquerade. Why? Because they still look on their greatest advantage as the advantage, as the fact that the world is so avid for peace that even Israel's friends will ultimately lean upon Israel and force her to break that which they know they cannot themselves do. And so they will always be moving towards involving the Big Four, involving the Security Council, rather than coming together and adjusting the issues which are outstanding. Peace can come in the Middle East. The Arab world really has much to gain from the presence of Israel. From Israel's trained manpower, her proven ability to make a barren land fertile, her scientific skill, all these could bring prosperity, and they could bring fertility, and they could bring much that was pleasing and necessary. War helps no one. War is costly. These little states are using up their gross national product, their wealth, for weapons which they can ill afford. Everyone needs peace. But yet, man being man, peace can come only when there is a willingness to sacrifice these pipe dreams, these hates, these old fanaticisms. And that's the question. The water is cold. We're not even sure there's water there, but we pray there may be. Amen.